Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute for International Policy. My name is Anthony Bubilo. I'm the Deputy Director and Research Director here at the Lowy Institute. And it's a pleasure to have you all here and in such large numbers for our special event on Brexit. After last week's vote by the UK to leave the EU, it's hard to escape the conclusion that we are at a pivotal point, certainly in recent history, not just for the UK and not just for Europe, but also for the rest of the world. Certainly in terms of Europe's recent history, Brexit seems as consequential as the fall of the Berlin Wall. And even if Brexit doesn't hobble the global economy, it has brought to the surface issues that certainly seem to resonate around the world, from the discontent with globalisation to growing concerns about inequality and the feelings of disenfranchisement amongst some sections of communities. And in fact, one indication of the great sense of Brexit being a turning point is the fact that this event was sold out in 45 minutes. So to help us understand the implications of Brexit, we've pulled together some of the Institute's best and brightest, and me, to talk through some of the issues and implications. To my left, we have Ewan Graham, the director of our International Security Program and a former UK diplomat, a former British diplomat, and possibly after Brexit, a former Briton. Alex Oliver, the director of our polling program, and Leon Berkelmans, the director of our International Economy program. So please join me in welcoming our three panelists. I want to start by asking the three of them about what happened, what have we actually seen here, and each will talk about issues that they're expert in. But Ewan, I want to start with you. I mean, as a UK citizen, as someone that obviously follows events in the UK very closely, what's happened? Much of the analysis at the moment seems to be that this is, you know, portraying this as some calamitous miscalculation by the British people. But there's also the sense that there is something real, and there are some valid concerns that this vote to leave the EU has expressed.
Well, normally I'd like to say I'm a neutral party, but in this I can't say I am. I mean, I am a British citizen. My father's from Scotland, my mother's from England, so I do have some legwork to cover, and I could be potentially pulled apart in those terms. So I voted Remain. And I felt very upset when the result came in. So I've now had a little bit of time to try and digest the difficult to digest. What happened? Well, first thing I think to remember is that this was not something that was grassroots driven. I mean, the referendum didn't emerge from the streets. There wasn't a clamour for it. The EU's always had popularity problems, and that some of those are, I think, you know, justifiable questions to be asked. But this came about as an internal Conservative Party matter. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, gave an undertaking to give a referendum back before the previous election. I think he bears personal responsibility for that judgment call, because had it not been for that, this wouldn't have been catapulted to the national stage and become such a divisive issue as it has. But we are where we are. UK politics is now in a very different space to what it was before the Leave campaign. Why did people vote to leave, and why did the polls and the conventional wisdom get it so wrong? Well, on the polls question, I'll defer to my colleague Alex. My take on this, and it's not particularly a sophisticated take, but there is an element of, if you like, a mob revolt here, a very traditional British response, but one that was effectively state-sanctioned through the referendum process. What do I mean by that? There is a sort of bottom line driver to this, which goes across a lot of the dysfunction that we're seeing in Western democracies, that there is an inequality issue. There is a rejection of globalization and the distribution of unequal distribution of its benefits. And that this was a fairly core, visceral rejection of that by the have-nots. And I think although most of the reporting of the demographic has focused on the age difference, and I think there certainly was a genuine element to that. I think the unspoken, ugly truth is that there was also a large class division to the way that the poll shook out. Now, there are, you could break that down and spend a whole day on that single question on its own right, but I think that that is there is something to that, for my money. And the Remain campaign, retrospectively, I think, hung their hat on a single issue, which was to advertise economic risk. Well, if you're trying to appeal and dissuade the have-nots, that was, I think, a wrong strategy. They didn't articulate a positive vision of what it meant to be influenced by Europe and in Europe, not simply the institution of the EU. And the Leave campaign, to put it bluntly, could just make it up. So they didn't have an expectation to deliver. This wasn't an inter-party platform. They were effectively a protest movement. So they had, I think, the easier side of the argument to make.
Alex, you know, people are talking about Brexit as a failure of political leadership, and you can, you know, argue that from, you know, in some respect you could say it was the success of political leadership on the Brexit side. But one of the things that it's very clear is that it's a failure of polling yet again. What's gone wrong here?
Well, just the first threshold point that I want to point out from a polling perspective is that Australians didn't want this to happen either. No. We issued a poll a couple of weeks ago, which we conducted in early June, which found that by a significant margin, the majority of Australians said that the UK should remain, and only 20% said that they should leave. The second point is the point that you make, and that is there's issues with polling and issues with politics, and that's global. It's not just British. The first issue is the issue of accuracy and reliability of polls, so a challenge to the science of polling. And the second one is a question of principle, is should we actually be conducting pre-election polls and have they swayed the vote? And there are a number of examples of that in the last decade of polling around the world, whether you're talking about the United Kingdom or the United States, and perhaps, you know, as we lead up to the Australian elections. What happened with the Brexit poll is that the polls predicted at the end, close to the vote, a Remain vote, and those polls were wrong. So those pre-election polling had the vote having Remain ahead by anywhere from a margin of, say, 4 points to 10 points. In the end, the result was the opposite, by a margin of about 2% and a million votes. So what went wrong? Voter turnout is the issue. Now, this is not something that is relevant to Australia, where we have mandatory voting and we're one of, say, 20 countries around the world that has compulsory voting. But voter turnout is obviously a big issue in the United Kingdom and in the United States. There's the issue of age, as Ewan has mentioned, the demographic break. The young people were Remainers, and we're hearing a lot of complaints now about the young completely protesting the result of this vote, but only 36% of them turned out. So there's that real question of youth complacency and disengagement, again, something we see globally. It was a weekday poll. This tended to favour old voters. The weather was bad. Then there's the issue of polling, and where who are people being honest in their responses to pre-election polling? In the UK, this is the issue of shy Tories versus lazy Labour voters. They're the two sort of monikers that have been given to these shy conservative voters. There's a suspicion that they're reluctant to answer questions about the direction that they'll vote in, such as a Brexit vote, because they're worried about being labelled as racist or anti-immigration. There's the lazy Labour voter, which who are hard to get out to actually vote, and the same issue happens in American elections. And the third issue is that polling has become unreliable, and this is a very big issue because of changes in methods, because of a communications revolution, because of a move to mobile. There's about 30% of the Australian population are only on mobile phones, and more than 10% of them are only on online voting, online systems, whether you're talking about the phone or the computer. They're mobile for everything, and that is changing, and it's changing rapidly. It's almost doubled in the last 4 years. So polling now has to grapple with the fact that what was a model that worked for the last literally 100 years and now has to change and adapt. You can't use telephone polling, or you can, but it's increasingly expensive, as we have found with our own polling program. So there's some of the issues, I think, that went wrong with polling. It's really exposed flaws in polling.
Leon, one of the arguments being put around now is that Brexit was also a vote against globalisation. Do you think that's right, and is it fair?
So my response to that will It's probably going to be a slightly different colour to Ewan's. One of the most interesting and I think best pieces I've seen on this topic has argued that social conservatism was actually a much better predictor of the vote rather than income or relative income decline or anything like that. And also immigration penetration was not a terribly good predictor. So those areas that have the most migrants actually voted to remain fairly overwhelmingly. So I suspect there's something other than globalisation going on. But just suppose that globalisation or people were worried that they were losing out and they were voting against this as a vote against globalisation. I think that they've, to some extent, getting the wrong target. So in this will be in the context of the US, but I would imagine the UK would be very similar. There was a little fact put into the economic report of the president last year, and that was saying that lower productivity growth since 1973 in the US is responsible for a fall in income relative to where they would have been of the median household of about $30,000 in the US. That's $30,000 per year. That's a big effect. Whereas higher inequality has reduced the income of the median household maybe by about $9,000. So that's still big. It's not as big as the productivity fall. But moreover, if you look at that increase in inequality, what is driving that? Is it globalization? I would argue it's certainly not all globalization. It might be somewhat globalisation. Is it 50-50? Again, I'm not entirely sure about that. Maybe I'd suggest perhaps it's a little less than that. But still, even globalisation there is not the big effect. The fall off in productivity, I think you would have to tell a very elaborate story without much supporting evidence to suggest globalisation is behind the fall in productivity. So even then, I think that if it is people upset with their by losing out, I think that they've got their target wrong.
Mm-hmm. Ewan, you want to take something else?
Another brief point to make. This was still a close result, 52 versus 48. I think a question has to be asked about the referendum itself. In Australia, for constitutional questions, you have a much higher bar, sensibly, I might add. You have to have a majority both nationally, but also to carry a majority in 4 of 6 states, and then a two-thirds majority is required in both houses. Just simply to do it on a popular vote and then suddenly find yourself shoehorned into the abyss without any further safeguard or check on a question of such vital importance, I think, is one of the retrospective questions that has to be asked.
I want to come now to the implications of this, and we'll leave the implications for Australia until the end, but let's just talk for the moment about the implications for the UK, for Europe, the world. I mean, Ewan, what do you see as the key political and strategic implications for UK and for Europe?
Well, a lot of people have talked about economic uncertainty being one cost already. I think the same applies in the political field, because we don't know yet what's going to happen. Mm. Article 50 hasn't been triggered. It could be, and it's a wild card scenario, that we may have an early general election before that process happens. In which case you could evenly see a potential for the UK to try and walk its way back from this. I don't think it's likely, but it is one scenario.
You're hanging on to hope by your fingernails, aren't you?
Like I said, I'm not entirely neutral on this. But I think what we can say for certain is whatever happens, now these now the Pandora's box has been opened on the question of two unions, not one, Europe, but also the unity of the United Kingdom. Mm. That will consume the energies of the political leadership of the UK, whoever's in charge, I think, for the medium term. That's going to come at an obvious cost in terms of the bandwidth that's available for global issues. The UK is not going to entirely ignore that, but I think it's a political fact of life that's going to be one obvious cost. And Europe, I think, too, is not has an not quite the same existential question hanging over it that the United Kingdom does, but it will be severely influential on the way that the relationship between member states and the European Commission structures now, I think, will be altered by this. It'll be very difficult for the grand European integration project to proceed as it has done before. I think there will be an expectation that that democratic voices at the national level will have to be heard. Maybe not on a leave or remain referendum. I think that risk is probably exaggerated in other countries. But certainly on major policy questions, it will. I think there will be a break that now is introduced as a result of this precedent.
I've read an argument, though, that military integration, military cooperation now in Europe will actually be easier with the UK gone, because the UK was often, a regular vetoer of closer military integration. Do you think that's right?
It's funny, because one of the myths perpetuated by the Leave campaign was the idea that the UK was going to be automatically forced to join a European army. I think that risk has always been overplayed. I don't see a European army becoming more likely as a result of this. Just on simple capabilities, if you're looking at countries in Europe that can project power globally, it still comes down to two, basically, France and the UK. Germany has a large defence budget, but not the same kind of capabilities. NATO still exists. NATO will become more important, especially for the US, as it looks to preserve its transatlantic security linkages. That will also, I think, reduce some of the security dislocation from Brexit. But whether the Europeans become more integrated, I think there's already been some backtracking from that. If you look at how defence firms have failed to integrate in the national level within the core Euro states, you've had fallouts between Sweden and Germany recently. So I think the trend has already been in reverse for some time, and I don't think that it's suddenly going to go into fast gear now.
Alex, what about polling? Has it become yet another dismal science? What are the things that have to happen, really, to restore people's faith in polling and the way it's used in politics?
Well, I think there's a real question mark over whether it can be fixed. You know, is it broken? I think it's a big question. There's an opinion piece in the New York Times last year. After a succession of badly predicted election results, the UK, the Scottish referendum, the US election in 2014, they just got it plain wrong. Mitt Romney predicted that he would win on the day of the voting. Clearly he didn't. So election voting, election polling in itself is in complete crisis. And the forces that I mentioned before, the sort of the move to mobiles, the move to online polling, and that's completely changed the probability model of polling, which has prevailed over the last century, which means that you keep on telephoning on the basis of a random selection of phone numbers from a phone book until you have filled your sample and you have a representative sample. When you've got an opt-in sample for people who are doing polling via the internet, which is increasingly the way it's being done, you take that element of randomness away, and therefore your sample is just simply not as representative as it was. And I think a lot of that is swaying these results. The second question, so I think that question is unresolved, whether election polling can actually ever be predictive again, and then what's the point of doing it? And the second one is really a question of principle, and that I touched on earlier, which is whether pre-election polling sways results. And there was a real question here about with the Remain vote looking significantly ahead by somewhere between 4 and 10 points ahead just before the vote. Did that discourage people from going out? Did it encourage a greater protest vote because those people thought that they were voting leave because it didn't matter, so they would just therefore have their little protest donkey vote? Or did it flush out more voters who had not intended to vote? Did it flush out more conservative voters? And then there was a real question whether demographics come into play, because on a weekday there are older voters who can go and do that and younger voters are stuck at work in the city. So I think they're the two main implications for polling. Do we now need to look at this model again of pre-election polling? In Canada they had blackout on pre-election polling until a couple of years ago, and the internet has made that almost impossible because you simply can't control the way these exit polls are publicised as people leave polling stations. So I think that genie is probably out of the bottle and can't be put back in again, but it really has changed the way that the reliability of polling and the very future of it in our political process.
This is not a technical question, right? This is given how much politics has become poll-driven. and not just before elections but through the year. This has some pretty profound implications for the way that politics is conducted, right?
Yeah, well, I think it's certainly undermining faith in the political process. And I think that's something that has implications not just for Australia but for the world.
Leon, the economic implications of this for the UK, but also for Europe, people are talking about, you know, a fairly gloomy outlook for the UK. Is that right? And a bit like the question I posed to Ewan, does the fact that the UK, that has to a degree been an obdurate member of the EU, does that actually make the task of EU economic integration actually easier?
So first, let's start off with the long-term implications. Perhaps the best study on this, or the study that's looked into this in most depth, was a study by the UK Treasury. Mm. They said that the exit from the EU would reduce GDP in the UK by between maybe 4 and 8% of GDP over a 15-year period. It's a little bit uncertain because we don't know what actually Brexit will look like. Are they going to remain part of the European Economic Area? So that's what people call the Norway option. The European Economic Area is the EU plus three Allied states, one of which is Norway, and that maintains access to the single market. The problem is that that also requires the UK to be open to EU migration. You've still got free movement of labour, and that was a really big motivating force for the Leave vote, I think. So that seems to be a difficult pill to swallow. If they're outside of the European Economic Area, that would be probably worse, and a source of that negative 8% effect I mentioned before. To me, that seems like a little bit too much. I'm surprised it's that high, but these numbers are really uncertain. So in the long term, there's uncertainty, which brings me to the short term. The short term, there is a lot of uncertainty, and that's bad. The UK Treasury also did numbers on the short term. They're predicting recession, so negative growth for the next little bit there. One of the more bearish forecasters out there. Others have put numbers to it to suggest it's not going to be as bad as that. But there's a lot of uncertainty, market volatility, and the economy and markets hate uncertainty. So why would you invest now? Why not wait another 6, 9, 12 months, see how everything's going to resolve itself before you in fact invest? And that's going to reduce economic activity in the here and now. In terms of Europe, well, some of the largest stock market falls actually occurred not in the UK itself, but in the fragile states of some of the more fragile states of Europe, and crucially the euro area. So why might that be? Well, my guess is that it brings exit of these more fragile states more into the picture. It makes exit of these guys more likely. And if they're part of the euro area, we've seen and we know that exiting this currency relationship can be extremely traumatic. All sorts of problems pop up to do with the banking system, and that can be really bad. So this has brought a really bad outcome for some of these more fragile European states onto the table. You also raise the question of, does this make the ability of the European Union to integrate a little bit more? So my guess would be yes, but again, uncertain.
I want to look at the implications for Australia. Alex mentioned that were Australians to have the vote, they would have fairly overwhelmingly voted for the UK to stay in the European Union. In terms of the kind of political and strategic dynamics, I mean, does this ultimately free the UK to focus more on Asia rather than Europe, to rejoin the Anglosphere as some of the Brexiters have argued for, or does it mean that because of the task of negotiating a new relationship with the EU, it's going to become all-consuming for the UK, and it will be able to focus less on the rest of the world?
As you said, I mean, there are potential opportunities, upside opportunities for countries like Australia. UK, if it leaves, will have to rely more on global opportunities. It'll look to Asia as a growth pole. and Australia, for obvious reasons, still a close relationship. In the short term, I don't see that really yielding great opportunities for Australia for the simple reason that under all scenarios, the UK remains part of the EU. Even if it triggers Article 50, it could be a two-year process. It's still bound by EU treaties, and its ability to go out and conclude a bilateral would be limited under those circumstances. In terms of the political and security dimensions, well, the Five Eyes intelligence network, I think, will continue. Also, the five power defence arrangements, which UK is a part, will remain. So those interfaces will remain for Australia. However, I think longer term, the question has to be asked, if the UK is still distracted, primarily looking inside, and especially if it has to deal with the existential question of managing a breakup of the United Kingdom, then Australia may feel that it has to look to all other partners. We talked about France. I think France-UK defence cooperation close to Europe will continue, and that's a good thing. But France has also engaged in a so-called strategic relationship with Australia. Mm. I think that will obviously be, a kind of competitive dynamic to that. And as Australia looks to thicken up its European linkages, it may be that France picks up some of the slack from a distracted UK.
Mm. I mean, the other interesting dimension for me is, as the UK looks for other markets to kind of bolster its kind of trading relationships, it's naturally going to look to Asia. And I wonder, is that going to then impact on the UK's willingness to, for example, as things become tense more in Asia, to side with the US and Australia versus China?
There's already been a lot of criticism of the UK for being beholden in its trade policy to China. I think that probably over-egged the case, but now certainly there will be even more reason for the UK to look to China as an alternative growth pole. Interestingly, if we're looking at China's reaction to this, there was a distinction between how China and Russia viewed the Brexit in advance of the referendum. Russia obviously, I think, sees this as a zero-sum window of opportunity. If UK is distracted and EU is splintered, then this is probably the time for Putin to make hay again. So we need to watch out for that scenario. But China was much more guarded, and I think China, for a couple of reasons. One, economically, it values the UK and its role as a passport into the EU. So there's an economic interest in status quo. And I don't think China sees that as a win situation if the UK is pulling out. Also, I think China believes in the EU as a kind of countervailing pole, multipolar system vis-a-vis the US. And in that sense, it doesn't want to see the institution weakened.
Alex, one of the interesting things about Brexit are some of the global resonances in that it has brought to the fore issues that other countries are dealing with. You mentioned earlier the question of inequality, of disillusionment, of disenfranchisement, things that we've including things we've detected in our own polling here on Australia. That kind of a few years ago when we asked in our poll about attitudes to democracy, and were surprised by the ambivalence certainly amongst youth towards democracy as a form of government. Well, I mean, what are the resonances that you see?
Yes, well, you're right. We sort of seen this coming, and I'm sure it was brewing for longer than we've actually been polling on it. But 2012, we ran our first poll, and we found that only 60% of the population, the adult population, saw democracy as being the most preferable form of government. And in fact, only around half, or even less than half, on some of those 5 years that we've been polling on this question, of the younger age group, the 18 to 29s, or so-called Y-geners, thought that democracy was the most preferable form of government, which was somewhat surprising. When we probed about that, it seemed that it's not actually about the idea of democracy, but about the way that our political system is working to serve the interests of democracy, that there's no real difference between the two major parties, that they're only serving vested interests. There's an overall disillusionment with the way our political system is delivering democracy. And so you mentioned disillusionment, disengagement, disenfranchisement. I think that leads to disengagement. Mm. And I think that's what we've seen in the Brexit poll with the low turnout of youth voters, despite the fact that they have passionate views about these things. And I think some of our results have have been criticised by particularly the young, saying we're not disengaged and we're not uninvolved and we do feel, we do care deeply about this, but they're not engaging with the political process that we currently have. At close of rolls on the 23rd of May, there were 600,000, over half a million, 18 to 24-year-olds not enrolled. That age group makes up 24% of all voters statistically. Around 70% of 18 to 19-year-olds were involved and 73% of 18 to 24-year-olds are enrolled, compared with 94% of 60-plus-year-old voters. So that demonstrates that degree of disengagement, which is a concern. And I think overall the implications will come back at us. We, you know, where are going to be the circumstances where we may experience a protest vote? And to me, the plebiscite, which we may be looking at later this year, might be one of those cases where we see
on gay marriage.
The plebiscite on equal opportunity for marriage. Sorry, there's a possibility for a real voter backlash if the plebiscite is held, and vote and MPs are not held to the popular vote, but they decide to either vote their conscience or to vote their electorate result. Then there's a possibility that we see that same sort of backlash and that same sort of disaffection and political dysfunction, which then becomes a vicious cycle, dysfunction, disaffection, leading to increasing dysfunction and disaffection.
There's a lesson there that, you know, if you give people the say on one issue, they won't necessarily confine themselves to that issue. They'll express, you know, other frustrations that they have with the system.
Yeah. Thank you for summing up.
Leon, obviously, day after the Brexit vote, it wasn't just the pound that took a hammering. Markets around the world, including Australia, also kind of suffered. I mean, what do you see as the consequences of Brexit? Again, difficult to know because still uncertain, but what do you see the kind of the short to medium term consequences for the global economy and also for the Australian economy?
Well, let me start with the Australian economy. Mm. Probably not all that much, probably. Direct trade ties with the UK, I think that's 3% of total trade. Investment, foreign direct investment, UK is a bigger deal there. So if we're talking stocks of foreign direct investment, both outward and inward, it's about 15%. So that's a bit chunkier, but I don't think that's threatened in any short term sense. I think the more interesting issue is this market volatility. Our market fell a little bit. Other markets fell more. There's a little bit of volatility out there. And when there's volatility, there's always the chance that someone's done something silly. Mm. And if somebody has done something silly, made a silly bet or something like that, it can raise stresses. People who are worried, financial institutions, there are questions of liquidity and solvency that come up, general panic. There were some people who were worried about that this could be some sort of Lehman moment. Mm. That has not panned out. It seems to, the financial system has seemed to deal with this stress. And indeed, we've seen things start to recover over the last few days. So I think overnight, things started normalising a little bit. So my best guess for Australia is not much at all. Mm. We may not see anything. Actually, I would expect that it'd be very hard to see any effect on Australia in aggregate statistics. Mm. The global economy, again, I think that sort of sentiment would be similar. That it's a big deal for the UK. You might get some spillover into Europe, but not a hell of a lot. And then more broadly, it's hopefully not going to be a big deal.
It's always good to get a bit of optimism. I'll now turn to the audience. As is normally the practice here at the Institute, please raise your hand and wait until someone's brought a microphone around to you and also tell us who you are.
Michael Sexton, I think it's a question for Leon. I wonder, you quoted the British Treasury figures about GDP fall. Did the British Treasury identify exactly why that would happen? I say that because one of the problems, I think, about the Remain case was that it continued to talk about the economic risks of leaving, but without really pointing out, I think, what they might be.
Sure. So that particular study, are you talking about the long-term one or the short-term one either? So the long-term one, what was primarily driving that result was a little assumption that they made in the paper that the fall in trade will affect productivity. Now, the actual evidence behind that is maybe, maybe not, but that's what they went with. And that's why I said that it's very uncertain. And if you ask me, that 8% number looked a little bit overcooked to me. I'm not entirely sure I buy it. But that was the crucial mechanism in that long-term one. In the short-term study, there were a number of things going on there, and they didn't really pass out what was happening. I suspect in that short-term piece, it was the uncertainty, and they estimated various statistical models that looked at the effect of uncertainty on economic activity, and they said, well, if there's a one standard deviation increase in uncertainty, then that would have the following effect on economic activity. So I actually feel that a little bit more that short-term study had a little bit more statistical meat there, a little bit more robustness there than that long-term study did.
Hi, I'm Philippa. I have heard that there is a risk that English will no longer carry the same weight as a language in use at the EU due to the fact that Britain is the only member nation that speaks English or has English as an official language. What effect would it have on Australia or other trading partners of the EU if they stop using English as their kind of core official language?
Ewan, the Queen's English on the way out?
Well, back to the French advantage again, I think. Let's see what happens. Ireland, of course, does speak English, they're unaffected.
Kind of, yeah.
Scotland. And Scotland, if it becomes another EU, then that will net itself out. You'll actually, if Northern Ireland chooses to become a third, you might actually get a net plus on the English-speaking countries within the EU. I don't really see that being a major swayer of how business or policy is decided in the EU. Look, I think England's lost some goodwill, obviously. UK has lost some goodwill from this. I think that's the bigger picture. It will be felt in a variety of ways. It may be that less English is spoken in the corridors of Brussels, but I think there's a much bigger issue. It's really about the fact that this was an unforced crisis, and I think that's the thing that really I worry about, whether UK has to leverage its influence, that will be countered against.
I want to draw you out a bit more on that. I mean, there's a clear imperative now for the EU to punish the UK, to preserve EU unity. But at what point do you think also some kind of common sense comes into play and says, well, hold on a sec, the UK is actually a valuable partner of Europe in certain areas. Or do you think it's just all going to be punishment? It has to be punishment at this point.
Some may err towards that side, and I think Nigel Farage's appearance in the European Parliament again won't have done any favours for that. But I think when cooler heads prevail, they'll look at the fact that this isn't just. I mean, this was a self-injuring decision that the UK made, but it makes a point to the EU that there's a wider problem. The wider problem is the dissonance between member states and the structures of the EU and the Commission in particular. And we've seen already some of those fault lines. On one extreme, Juncker has come out with the harder line positions, whereas Merkel and others, although they certainly aren't giving the UK any breadth on Article 50, have given a somewhat more conciliatory message. And I think that's in recognition that the EU is at a chronic low in its popularity with member state populations. Even France has a popularity rating in the last month or so for the EU at about 38%. So if they were going to call a snap referendum, they may well end up with an exit scenario there.
So first Brexit, then Frexit.
And where does it stop? I mean, ultimately, I think that will... There'll be a lot of anger, but I don't think that will translate into an entirely punitive policy on the part of the EU.
But it can only stop. It stops with countries that start with consonants.
Rob McDougall, Canadian consulate. One quick comment. The problem on English language is that you can only be an official language in the EU if your language is nominated. And at the moment, the only country that's nominated English is the UK. So there is a potential issue there. However, two questions quickly. One, short-term big movement on exchange rates, is that going to last? Or is there going to be, are things going to settle down as the rest settles down? The other one is free trade agreements. Aside from the fact that the EU and the UK are likely to be spending a big chunk of the next few couple of years worrying about essentially each other's free trade agreement, will this have an effect on the global FTA?
So in terms of, I assume this is for me, in terms of exchange rates are basically unpredictable. The best prediction for them is what they are at today. So what we saw was a big movement in the pound down. That's come off somewhat, but I would expect that there has been a fundamental change here. This has been a change for the British tradable sector and their ability to operate, and I would expect that to be reflected in the exchange rate on some sort of permanent basis. On FTAs, my guess is yes, it has some sort of effect. What this does, for example, with the TTIP, the one between the EU and the US, I can't even remember what it stands for now. But I would imagine that this throws a bit of a spanner in the works. And who knows? One of the more uncertain things that we're coming across.
Good afternoon. My name's Tim Galt, and first of all, I'd thank the panel for a very interesting discussion. It's certainly a consuming topic. My question, I suppose, is ultimately about the effect of polling in advance of the referendum, and ultimately goes to the credibility of the referendum itself. It strikes me, and for professional reasons, I've kept a very close eye on the polls going into the referendum, and betting markets were, I think, what most people were referencing and following, and clearly the weight of money in London and the ultimate vote that London gave weighed heavily on that particular aspect, i.e. the betting market. So my question ultimately is the appropriateness of legislation around current market activity as it relates to gambling in advance of these events, because I would deduce that in this instance it's had potentially a very unfortunate impact.
Alex?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I hadn't actually sort of extrapolated to the betting markets, but that there's been a strong correlation between the final betting market and the final result. But in this case, I think it was the other way around. So the implications, I think, are for pre-election polling, the sort of polling that we see from Ipsos and News Poll. I think there may be a real thrust to examine the role of those polls. As for the betting markets, well, good luck with trying to regulate those and dealing with the sort of vested interests that we have here, and I think probably that applies across the globe as well. But I think you're right. I think they have had a significant effect and have swayed the vote, as I mentioned before. It's an additional factor which has affected what would otherwise be a fairly clear-cut vote. So I think it is a very big issue that we need to address, but I suspect we probably won't, as a nation, address it.
The fact that they've been proven wrong this time might be a natural corrective to the next scenario.
Hi, I was just wondering, you mentioned a few times that the European Union is structurally weak, there's a rise of Euroscepticism in many of the member countries. I was just wondering, like, what kind of structural changes would need to happen within the EU to re-strengthen it?
I think the dangers of fragmentation, as I said, I think are probably overplayed. If you look to all the accession states east of Germany, they're looking over their shoulders at a resurgent Russia. I don't think there's any sort of resiling from the EU or centripetal tendencies there. But I think in the core EU states, and I mentioned again that very striking French poll, France must be, along with Germany, the core state to any European Union. The fact that it's drifted now to such a low factor of support, I think, it should serve as a wake-up call that this is not just the tricksy Brits, that there is a structural issue, a political issue, and I think we probably do need to wind back the clock and look maybe whether the EU, as long back as Maastricht, actually took a wrong turning, and that there was no imperative to go for the maximalist integrative super state solution that clearly some do favour. So I think there'll be a natural break, like it or not. I think that's just the political reality, that the member states will probably rein in the Commission from now. In terms of how mechanically that works, in terms of structures, I don't have an easy answer for you there, but I think we may see more of these mini referenda in future in terms of national member states going out to get a popular vote on significant changes of policy in future.
Yeah. There are still some structural fragilities there with the euro. There was a report, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but there was a report put out by some economists just recently, including Olivier Blanchard, he's currently at the Peterson Institute, former chief economist of the IMF, that discussed some of these things, discussed some of the somewhat boring issues that would help to really strengthen the euro area, things like improving the deposit insurance system amongst banks there, that there are some fragilities there that need to be fixed. And if you could do that, I think that would really help avoid the kind of crises that we've seen associated with the euro.
We've got about 10 minutes left, so I might take a few questions and then get the panel to answer them. So I'll start here. And please, if you can, to keep your questions short.
Yeah, Clyde McConaghy, Optima Boards. The platform of immigration for the Leave campaign, what implications do you see for immigration or indeed immigration as a result of it, such that it's almost the British equivalent of the stop the boats, whether it's rightly or wrongly. So do you think there might be, let's call it a rapid influx over the next 2 years or so into Britain, or indeed a number of people who might have recently, let's say in the last 5 years, come to Britain who change their mind if it's not going to be part. Maybe they go north in order to remain in the EU.
We'll take another couple. Just here, just in front of the pillar.
Would it be unfair to say at this stage that nobody really knows what the outcome of the...
And right at the back there.
You've had some stability through the euro area in terms of global politics with Cameron for 5 years, with Merkel for a large number of years, and Hollande. Merkel's got an election next year. Hollande's under a lot of pressure on reform policies in France. Cameron's gone. What's the impact not only for Europe but also flowing through into other global institutions like the G20?
Okay, so we have three questions there. Immigration, do we really know, any implications for other global institutions? Who wants to have a first go?
On the migration question, it's interesting to see the Leave platform now rowing back on many of their promises ahead of the election and making statements that freedom of movement may have to be part of a post-EU settlement. I think that's in blunt recognition that it's very difficult to run a modern economy without accepting some form of labour mobility. Otherwise, the very worst end of Lyon's GDP loss figures may look optimistic. So I think that will have an inevitable moderating effect on the sharpness of the politics around migration, but migration certainly was the touchstone issue, I think, at the bottom of it, and that goes back to previous elections too. I think it's a reason that Labour realised why they did so badly in the last election was to fail to come up with something that would politically assuage voters who are most worried about that. The scenario that you would point to of young Brits going north to a rump EU in Scotland, I think, it's not a out of the realm of possibility one, and it would be reversing the flow of population for 300 plus years, as Scotland would then seek out opportunities to position itself, for financial institutions that are no longer able to benefit from being in London. Very unpredictable. But I think I don't think the drawbridge will slam shut along Nigel Farage lines in the worst case scenario. I just don't see that happening. I'll just take the second question and leave the third. Where do I think we can be certain is the distraction value, because whatever happens, I think there will be now an inherent need for whoever's in charge in the UK to deal with A, the relationship with Europe, and B, UK's relationship with its own constituent nations. Under any scenarios, those have now come up in a way that I think cannot be put back easily into the box. What I worry about, I was going to say in advance of this panel that nobody died, and then I realised, of course, that we had a political assassination as part of this campaign. I really worry about the UK's politics now being more polarised than they've ever been, certainly in my lifetime. I think that's another genie that's very difficult to put back into place. And I think, unfortunately, that is now a new political reality.
Alex, Leon, do you want to take on any of the three questions?
I'll start off with the G20.
Yeah.
So the G20, I think your question was about turnover of leaders in Europe and what effect that has on the G20. The G20 will continue, I think, to hold completely ineffectual summits, and it will continue to do that. The G20 was good during the crisis, and since then, I think, has lost its sway. I see no reason that this will change.
It's from the Lowy Institute, the home of the G20 studies.
That's quite right. On the question of the outcome, I was quite struck that when you look at the question that was posed to the British population, do you want to remain or do you want to go out? Okay, what does out mean? You contrast that to, say, what we faced in 1999, where we had a vote on the Republic and we had a very specific alternative. Now, you can talk about the pros and cons of that alternative. And you might say that actually it's not a good comparison, because this case, the Europe case, has vastly bigger implications for institutions. My response to that would be all the more reason to put some structure around it. All the more reason to help guide us in this incredibly uncertain period. So I think that the design of the referendum was flawed in many respects.
Alex?
I just wanted to pick up that point about immigration, because I think it's a very good point. One of the things that we have noticed in our own public opinion in Australia on immigration is that we are pro-immigration. We like the concept of border control. In our latest poll, we found that the majority of Australians think that turn back boats is still a good policy, and yet overwhelmingly, just nearly three quarters of Australians are pro-immigration. They think it's good for the economy. They think it's good for the country. They think that they value migrant skills and talents. So I wonder if one of the results of the Brexit referendum will be, or should be, you know, some controls, additional controls over borders, whatever that might look like, and the result would be a more positive attitude towards immigration. I guess that's a lesson that we seem to have seen from public opinion on immigration and refugees here. Not saying I agree with the popular opinion on that, but that is what appears to be the opinion.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to those that didn't get an opportunity to ask a question. We could talk about this for a lot longer, but as we pride ourselves at the Institute on finishing on time, we'll have to bring it to a close there. It's been a great discussion. I'd like to thank my colleagues at the Institute for doing it at quite short notice. Please join me in thanking our panellists. And we'll see you all next time. Thanks.